Lecture 14. Death or Glory? Spartan Military Education.
Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. In this lecture, we move from Sparta's political order to its social, and to the other reforms ascribed to Lycurgus in the social and economic spheres. One was the redistribution of the land of Laconia. Apparently, Lycurgus tried to redress the inequality between the people. He seems to have taken the land of Laconia that is, and simply parcelled it out in equal shares amongst everyone. Perhaps this is why the farmers in Attica were badgering for a land redistribution, knowing what had happened to the Spartans. Now, Lycurgus's land redistribution must have taken place after Sparta became the polis of Laconia. But certainly an allotment of land was something a man could expect when he completed the military system of education, which we'll go on to talk about in a moment. The land allotment was called a kleros, but it had more than a symbolic meaning, like a graduation present today. A man had to have a kleros to be recognized as a Spartan citizen, a Spartiate. And what it produced, its crops, was his income, the income that allowed him to fight in the army to maintain his membership of his barracks. One other major reform attributed to Lycurgus, which I've mentioned a couple of times and we can now turn to in some more detail, was the system of military training called the agoge. This was coupled with the introduction of common messes or barracks. This system became the core of a Spartan man's education in the state. And I think it's what characterized Spartan society the most. The agoge was compulsory for all males. Until the age of 7, boys and girls played together and trained together in the nude. This was, the other Greeks thought, was a little bit off. And yet, the other Greeks, of course, thought child prostitution was okay. That the boys had made it this far, that is to age 7, was only because someone else, not their parents, had deemed them healthy. Parents in Sparta were only allowed to keep fit male babies. We're told that the father brought his male baby to the eldest member of his tribe. This person would inspect it. And if the baby was deemed fit, in other words, if it had all its fingers and toes, if it didn't have croup, if it didn't have any of the sort of deformities, then the baby was assigned a kleros for when it graduated the agoge. If it was considered unhealthy or deformed, it was left out on the slopes of Mount Taygetus to die. According to Plutarch in his Life of Lycurgus, leaving the baby out to die was better for the child as well as the state. Now, we're not going to get into any moral problems about whether a hideously deformed child in any way should be left out to die, but notice, though, better for the state. The parents had no say in the matter. At age 7, girls and boys were segregated. Girls carried on living at home, though they still underwent physical training. But at age 7, the boys left their homes and they went to live in a military mess, a barracks, if you like, and it was called a syssitium. Now, there were a number of these messes, or syssitia, that's the plural of syssitium, and modern historians estimate that each one had in it perhaps 16 to 20 or so males. So it's not enormous, like a big dormitory or a youth hostel. The boys probably went to the same syssitium as their fathers, so they followed in a sort of family tradition. Just like today, it's often the case for children to go to the same schools or universities as their parents. Now, the boys grew into men in the Sicetion, because they lived in the mess from age 7 to 30. They were not allowed to move into their own homes until they hit 30. They were allowed to marry, usually in their early 20s, but then they had to visit their wives in secret, only when there was no moon. This is a very odd practice to us, and it's described and then explained by Plutarch in his Life of Lycurgus. He says that the Spartan husband, and I'm going to quote now, "The Spartan husband took care to visit his wife secretly, ashamed and anxious in case he was seen by someone in his house. His wife came up with all sorts of intrigues and schemes about how they could meet up with each other and no one would see them. The young husbands would do this sort of thing, not for a short period of time, but it went on and on, so that they might even have children before finally they saw their own wives in the daylight." Remember, this is nights when there's no moon. "Having sex in this way was not just for self-control or moderation. It ensured that husband and wife were physically fertile, always in love, and ripe for sex, as opposed to having had enough and being pale from overindulgence." There are two things at work here. There is the shame factor from being seen, since stealth was considered very important to a Spartan soldier. And there was also the belief that the less a husband had sex with his wife, the greater his sperm count, and hence the ability to produce healthy children. But the upshot of this system is that by the time graduates of the agoge could move into their own homes at the age of 30, they might already have one or two children, the eldest of which could be 4 or 5. And indeed, the eldest, if it was a boy, might be leaving in a couple of years' time to go and live in his Sicetion to begin the agoge. Even when husbands were allowed to live in their own home, they were still required to spend every weekend in the Sicetion and to eat dinner there every evening with their comrades in arms. That was because Spartan men were required to serve in the army until they were 60, and so training needed to be ongoing even after graduating the agoge. Incidentally, we shouldn't see these mess dinners as akin to symposia or the drinking parties, as is sometimes the case. The Greeks loved their symposia, but the Spartans were quite different. They drank very sparingly because they were well aware of the dangers of getting drunk. Nor was the dinner they ate anything to look forward to. The regular Spartan fare was something called black broth, and this was basically pork cooked in blood with salt and vinegar. Not very nice indeed, I'd think. The training in the agoge was often brutal. Now, we don't have a lot of information about this, but we do know about the broad outlines. There was no instruction, for example, in reading, writing, mathematics, current affairs, or anything like that. The emphasis in the agoge, the emphasis in Spartan society indeed, was on physical toughness, obedience, fighting hoplite style, and stealth. At age 7, the young boys were divided into what the Spartans called herds for their physical and obedience training. At age 12, they cut their hair short and they moved to what today we would call military maneuvers. This would be something like being dropped off in the middle of nowhere and having to find your way home with only a compass and perhaps some minor medical and rations in the pockets of your uniform. In Sparta, though, the boys were starved of food and water for up to a week before sending them out into the middle of nowhere. They didn't have uniforms. In fact, they wore only one cloak all year round and no shoes. Sometimes they were even forced out into the field on these maneuvers naked. They had to forage to survive. They had to steal. And if they were caught stealing, they were punished. not for the crime, but for being caught. These maneuvers, by the way, went on throughout the year. Doesn't matter if there was snow on the ground in midwinter or blazing heat in midsummer. At age 14, the boys became known as Ephebs. And while the sort of training I've just been talking about continued, you know, being dropped off in the middle of nowhere with just a compass and a banana or something, they began to take part in military campaigns. Now, this period as an Ephebe would last until about the age of 20 or so, when they grew their hair long again and also grew the distinctive Spartan beard, the style that has this long beard but no mustache. As I said, at this age, in the early 20s, give or take, our Spartan was allowed to marry, but he had to carry on living in his Syssition until he was 30. At that time, when he was 30, he graduated. He received his kleros, the one that had been assigned to him by the tribal elder when he was just a baby, and he became a full Spartan citizen, or Sparti 8. To maintain that status, he had to continue paying mess dues, membership dues, if you like. These would be in food and drink, something like that, and he had to maintain these for the rest of his life. If he didn't, or if he could not, he would no longer be a Sparti 8. Now, a lot of Spartan boys and men must have failed the agoge. Some would have died in training or dropped out. And we know this happened, as I said in our last lecture. There was this status called inferiors or tremblers. These unfortunate wretches had to wear coloured patches on their cloaks. And when they were adult males, they were not allowed to wear the full Spartan beard. This meant that they were instantly recognisable. It's a shame factor. It's a shame factor not just for them, but also their families. They had let their family down as well as their state because they hadn't made it through the agoge. And so people would turn their backs on them, literally. The goal of the agoge was twofold. It was to produce first-rate soldiers to fight and die for the state without question. And second, it was to train future members of the Crypteia, the secret police. Now, the Crypteia tracked the activities of the Spartan slaves, or helots as they were called, and these slaves posed a big threat to domestic security. They're what I call the Achilles heel of Sparta, and I want to talk about them in a lot more detail in the next lecture because they fit into it better than here. To the Spartans, politics and home life came second. And this was something the Athenians, indeed the Greeks overall, couldn't understand. The Athenians, the Greeks generally, recognized the need to fight. They thought that there was nothing nobler than dying to protect your way of living and your city's freedom. But this wasn't the be-all and end-all of their role in society. Involvement in civic life was paramount to the Athenians, for example. They had schools where one could learn rhetoric, philosophy. Through conversation and dialogue, their citizens could learn and talk about politics, current affairs. Again, the Spartans' attitude to civic life and what they considered important, that's fighting versus taking part in the political system or learning things, helps us to understand why they were looked at as being different by the other Greeks. So it's not just us that can look on the Spartans and say, they have a different lifestyle. The other Greeks, their contemporaries, felt the same way. We gain a vivid insight into what life in the agoge was like from Plutarch's Life of Lycurgus and from a work by the 4th century writer Xenophon called The Constitution of the Spartans. And I want to read out extracts from Xenophon now because this brings to life the agoge and what life was like in it far better than if I just stand here and describe it, because this is a contemporary Greek writing about it. So here we go. Rather than letting boys' feet grow soft in shoes, he, now that's Lycurgus, told them emphatically to make them strong by not wearing shoes, in the belief that this practice should enable them to walk uphill with greater ease and come down in greater safety. And the boy who is accustomed to having no shoes on his feet should jump and bound and run faster than the one with shoes. Instead of their clothes serving to make them delicate, he required them to become used to a single garment all year round, the idea being that thereby they would be better prepared for both cold and heat. As for food, he instructed the iron, that's like the person in charge of the syssitium, he instructed the iron to furnish for the common meal just the right amount for them never to become sluggish through being too full, while also giving them a taste of what it is not to have enough. Now, this sort of thing was to help the men when they were on campaign. They would be better able to handle hardships. And if there were times when they couldn't get enough food, well, they'd be used to this feeling anyway. It wouldn't affect their ability to fight. They'd just shrug it off. Xenophon continues. I'd like to continue our quote from Xenophon. On the other hand, continues Xenophon, while he, that's Lycurgus, did not allow them to take what they required effortlessly to prevent them from suffering from hunger, he did permit them to engage in some stealing in order to ward off starvation. So here we see the state condoning the practice of stealing. Let me continue with Xenophon. I imagine everyone is aware that he didn't let them get food by trickery because he was unable to provide for them. Clearly, a prospective thief must keep awake at night and by day must practice deception and lie in wait, as well as have spies ready if he's going to seize anything. So clearly, it was Lycurgus's wish that by training the boys in all these ways, he would make them more resourceful at feeding themselves and at being better fighters. Someone might ask then, if he considered theft a good thing, why on earth did he inflict many lashes on the boy who was caught? My answer is, remember this is Xenophon talking here, my answer is because, as in every other branch of instruction, people chastise anyone who does not respond satisfactorily. So the Spartans too punished those who were caught as being incompetent thieves. And after making it a matter of honour for them to snatch just as many cheeses as possible from Orthia, he commanded others to whip them, wishing to demonstrate thereby the point that a short period of pain may be compensated by the enjoyment of long-lasting prestige. We see in these extracts the measures taken in the agoge to toughen boys and men, to improve their abilities to steal, to be able to run and fight better, all of which would benefit them and their fellow soldiers when on campaign. The brutality of the system is well illustrated by the anecdote about cheese stealing. This was an annual ritual whereby boys would try to steal cheese off the altar of Artemis or Thea, and older boys were to guard that altar and whip them to prevent them stealing the cheese. The idea was that these youngsters would be trained to resist pain. They weren't supposed to cry out as they were whipped, because that would be unmanly. We're told that the altar would often be drenched in blood from these whippings, and that at times some of these boys died during this ritual, died from the whippings. And there was a big group of spectators watching this. And we thought the Romans were bloodthirsty. We note also from the passage I just read out that the boys were not beaten for committing the crime. This is where the stealth training comes in. The idea behind this is that the good, artful dodger types would be better able to infiltrate enemy lines and enemy camps when on campaign. And especially, they would become members of the Krypteia, the secret police force. After all, even today, aren't secret agents supposed to be secret? That explains why a Spartan was punished if, for example, he was caught stealing. The crime itself didn't matter. What did was being caught. Which doesn't make for being a good spy, does it? That's another reason why it was shameful to be seen visiting your wife before you were allowed to live at home. Another aspect of the agoge system, or one that it spawned anyway, was what we might call institutionalized homosexuality. In other words, as the boys grew up with one another in their syssition, remember they were in there from age 7 to 30, friendships would develop that would turn sexual, that would become erotic. Now this was something the state condoned. As long as these sexual relationships develop normally rather than out of lust. Lycurgus apparently cracked down hard on any man who pursued a boy just for his body. That's the lust factor. But as long as someone was of the right character, who befriended a boy first, got to know him as a friend, and then out of that friendship, the relationship turned sexual, that was okay. In a place like a syssition, with males living in it from 7 to 30, the number of same-sex relationships, which were normal in Greece anyway, must have been rampant. We should step back for a minute and talk about the term homosexuality. We have to be very careful here. The Greeks had no such term as we do today. They even didn't have the term bisexual. If you went back in a time machine and saw two women together or two men together and said, oh, are they lesbians? Are they gay? They wouldn't know what you were talking about. To the Greeks, bisexuality was fine. Homosexuality was a term that wasn't even coined until a century or so ago. The Greeks admired the body, as we know. And the bottom line was this. As long as a relationship was founded on friendship first, then it was okay for that to turn sexual, even if both partners were of the same sex. What was frowned upon, though, was for example, for an older man to lust after a younger boy because of, as I said, this lust factor. We have a number of forensic speeches from the 4th century BC in which we hear about older men pursuing younger boys and in the process making fools of themselves. The Athenians didn't think this was cool. They looked down at that. This is also why they looked down at male prostitution. They thought this was the lowest of the low. Male prostitutes could even be indicted. And the reason why they could be indicted, the reason why male prostitutes were looked down upon was because they assumed the position of the woman. In other words, you know, if a man went to a woman for sex, a courtesan or a prostitute, that was okay. But if a man assumed the role of the woman, then he was being unmanly. This feminine aspect that the Athenians and presumably the other Greeks didn't like. So when we start talking about institutionalized homosexuality in Sparta, sometimes people take a step back and they can't understand why this tough, macho race like the Spartans would engage in homosexuality and that somebody like Lycurgus, and indeed even the state, condoned it. It just seems a contradiction. But we're looking at the development of same-sex relations, erotic same-sex relations from friendship. And that was the difference. That was what differentiated it between what the Greeks thought of same-sex relationships and how we're kind of still critical of them. There were some attempts even in Sparta to try to monitor a sexual relationship between two males. For example, it was frowned upon for an older man to have a sexual relationship with a boy once that boy's beard had begun to grow. So there was some attempt then to try to control relationships then. And perhaps even same-sex erotic relationships, sexual relationships, grew up because of the Syssition, grew up because of the fact that married males couldn't live at home until they were 30. And so in a way, this might be far-fetched, I don't know, but in a way, because the married male was denied the marital relationship that he would have had at home because he was forced to live in the Syssition for another few years after getting married, then in effect that same-sex sexual relationship takes the place of the marital one. Remember, men could not visit their wives except on dark nights, and even then it was only for a quickie. So there was no conversation, presumably, no chatting about things that a husband and wife would do if they lived under the same roof all the time. But there's more than just the physical side to the male-male relationships, not just in Sparta, but in Greece as a whole. There's a military factor as well. The idea being that in battle, the soldiers would be fighting on behalf of the state, yes they were, but they would also be protecting their lovers. And hence they would fight more ferociously to protect their lovers as they stood next to them in the battle line. Now this idea of lovers standing firm together, so to speak, is not unique to Sparta. The famous Sacred Band of Thebes, and we'll return to this down the track, but the Sacred Band of Thebes was an elite infantry force. It would be akin to something like the American Special Forces or the British SAS today. In other words, it was the creme de la creme, shall we say. This sacred band was 300 strong, and it was composed of 150 pairs of lovers. And that was deliberate, the idea being that that these lovers would fight more ferociously for each other, they would stand firm against the enemy. And this is perhaps one reason why the entire sacred band of Thebes refused to budge at the Battle of Chaeronea in Boeotia in 338 BC. This is the battle where Philip II of Macedonia defeated the Greeks and imposed Macedonian hegemony over Greece. And in that battle, Philip's 18-year-old son Alexander, the future Alexander the Great, annihilated the sacred band. It didn't move, and it was cut down to the last man. All in all, graduates of the Agoge in Sparta certainly earned their kleros, didn't they? If they survived through this brutal training, did they ever need that allotment of land? And we can see also why the Spartan army earned the reputation it did as the best trained and toughest fighting force in Greece. There is no question that the fame of the Spartan army spread far and wide. It reached as far afield as Asia Minor, for example. Everyone had heard of the Spartans. Everybody admired the Spartan army. But the lifestyle, on the other hand, what society expected of the Spartans, that was something entirely different. And that's why I said the other Greeks both admired and detested the Spartans at the same time. Now, we've been talking about the Spartan males an awful lot. But if you think the Spartan women get off easy in the system, well, think again. As I mentioned earlier, at age 7, boys and girls were separated, with the boys going to live in the Syssition until the age of 30. Girls continued living at home where they were looked after by their mothers, but they still continued with physical training, the idea being to make them strong and healthy. And that was because of society's expectation, Spartan society's expectation, that is, of their women. The job, if you like, of a Spartan woman was not to run the oikos, like in Athens, was not to look after her man. It was to bear strong babies, especially male babies, because these strong babies would grow up either to fight for Sparta if they were boys, or to bear strong babies if they were girls. In our next lecture, we'll talk more about women and their place in society. Then I want to discuss why the Agoge was introduced and when, And then finally, I want to bring in the rise of the Peloponnesian League. This league propelled the Spartans into the wider arena of Greek affairs. But the big question is, could their society handle it? Thank you very much.